When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Will turned back to the dead man, his father. A thousand things jostled at his throat, and only the dashing rain cooled the hotness in his eyes. The little lantern still flickered and flared as the draft through the ill-fitting window licked around the flame, and by its light, Will knelt and put his hands on the man's body, touching his face, his shoulders, his chest, closing his eyes, pushing the wet grey hair off his forehead, pressing his hands to the rough cheeks, closing his father's mouth, squeezing his hands.
Welcome to His Darker Materials, where we run through the BBC HBO show His Dark Materials, episode by episode. So just before we go any further, spoiler warning for season one and all of season two. We're at the last episode. We're going to spoil the lot. So if you haven't seen everything so far, please go away, watch it, and then come back. As ever, if you'd like to get in touch with us, we're on Instagram at Stripped Media, Twitter at Stripped Media UK, and use the hashtag His Darker Materials. Once again, my name is Helen O'Hara. I am delighted to be joined, as ever, by my co-host, Dave Corkery.
Hello, Helen. Good morning.
Hello, and I am particularly delighted, nice as Dave is, that we are joined by another guest. Russell Dodgson is here with us today. He's the VFX supervisor for His Dark Materials. He was with us last season and is now going to do the same expert job of explaining how they did it all this year. Hello.
Hello again. How are you?
No pressure.
You got this, Russell.
Indeed.
Just be fine. Do exactly what you did last year again.
Can you just play last year's again?
It's easy.
there's a surprising amount about bears, though, in last year compared to this year. So.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Let's get into it, Russell. So demons. Fewer demons, but more of them, I guess.
Yes, that seems to be the take home. Yeah, it was nice to have that kind of slight breather from constantly panicking about whether people would consider the world too empty, not full enough, too full or whatever. So it was nice to be able to focus, make it a bit more character-based, introduce a couple of new forms for Pan that kind of represent Lyra's journey a bit more. It was really nice to kind of have that slight pressure off and sort of really dig into the demons as characters more, I guess, than we did last year.
Is this the optimal amount of demons for you then, from a VFX point of view?
Maybe, I don't know. We'll see. I think I'm always happiest when the money is going on character development. Basically, that's my answer. So if there's, you know, like season one, when we had dialogue sequences between Lyra and Pan or between Lyra and Yorick, I was really happy. That's when I feel like everything is working and it's doing its job. I never really feel particularly comfortable when we're shelling out cash and filling screens up with background things that aren't helping the story along. So yeah, to me, it's a bonus. Yeah,
well, there's plenty of that in this episode, which we'll get into. Yeah,
yes.
So, what were the big challenges then this season? Because I know last season, you know, you talked about obviously demons, you talked about armored bears. What's been the big challenge this year?
Coronavirus.
Fair. Yes.
Yeah, that's been the big one. I mean, the truth is that there's been a few things that have been challenging, and they've been a bit unexpected, I think. So the spectres are really difficult. They're very difficult from a story perspective and from a visual perspective. The windows are alarmingly tricky to get something that feels right. And we can go into them in detail. I'm just sort of giving you the overview. And then I think the one thing that was fairly tricky was because we lost an episode, we had to kind of approach in the edit at not a too late a stage, but you know, when we were wanting to turn those things over into visual effects to execute the shots, we were actually still trying to work out what parts of that episode we wanted to sort of reference in other episodes and what we needed to do to bolster things in different places. So,
Russell, could I just ask you to give some of our listeners may not be aware about how you lost an episode. Do you mind just giving them a very quick bit of context there?
We just couldn't find it. No,
I think it's in your house. I can see it behind. Is that it in your shelf?
It might be. So basically, what we did is we had our normal 8 episodes, which was our plan, and we had one episode which was because James McAvoy isn't in, or Lord Asriel isn't in book 2. He's referenced, but he's not physically in it as a character. And we always wanted to be able to sort of track what he's doing a little bit. So what we did is we had an episode that was kind of a standalone episode that was going to sit in the middle. And it kind of gave us a bit of insight into what Asriel was doing, which I'm not going to tell you now, because in case we need it for later, I'm very sorry. It had some nice, the one thing it did have is, was it had some nice Spectre information in it.
Right.
I guess would be a way of putting it. And and we were going to shoot that due to availability and just actor availability and just the way things worked out timing wise. We were going to shoot that in the new year after we'd wrapped on our 7 other episodes in December. And then just what happened was we started shooting. We got about a week in and it just became really clear that we shouldn't be doing it anymore. Mm. And we
2020.
And we had to pull the plug, and it was a bit heartbreaking because it was going to be pretty good. But it is what it is. And we're lucky that it was standalone, so that the season itself works as a whole narratively and finishes. I mean, it would have been heartbreaking if we'd finished the season without actually having an ending. That would have been really bad. It would have been like the original it would have been like the original movie, actually, where they didn't do that very last end point. So
do you think there's a chance that we might see that at the beginning of our next season potentially?
I don't think so. I think that's above my pay grade, but I think that I think this story has momentum and it has an energy, and you don't go backwards with Lyra's Odyssey. Do you know what I mean? It's all about.
I know.
It's a shame.
I know. It's just because it is a big, like what he's doing during that book is a big, you know, gap in the books, frankly. Yeah, it's a big question. Because again, I'm not going to get into spoilers for any future books, but when we meet him again, his circumstances have substantially changed from where we saw him.
Alarmingly, I'd say.
and so I was really excited to see that. So I hope, we'll talk about it. We get a tiny hint of that this episode, but I would just love more of that. I just think that's such an exciting thing to be able to create.
I mean, if I were you guys, I'd be looking at other mediums or ways of making that, like give us a comic book or give us a podcast or give us an animated.
I'd love to do. There's a few, you know, because there's all these really nice spin-off books that Pullman wrote as well, like, you know, Once Upon a Time in the North. I'd love to do little animated like specials of those things. Oh, I think they'd be really good fun. But you know, hey, maybe one day, who knows.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
BBC, are you listening?
I know you are.
Russell, that money, please.
You can give me the money. That'd be great. You won't end up with a TV show, though.
You've kind of covered off what the biggest challenges were, and we, you know, we'll get into, let's chat about the specters and the windows in a little bit. But looking back at season 2 now, what's the thing that you are most proud of that you and the team achieved?
That's a good question. I think it comes back to my same sort of topic. It's characterizing demons and conversation. There is and also sort of I personally think we did a really good job when we went off canon. And we added things. I think we added things that help a lot of the time. So my favorite scene in the whole show is Mrs. Coulter and Lyra going at it in Boreal's basement and getting Pan attacking and getting that kind of role reversal, because it's really good. It's good character work that I think really helps the story, and it helps all the relationships, and it pushes things forwards narratively. And I think the visual effects played a really important part in the tension of it. So to me, that's, you know, it's things like that. We had to do, there's a scene with Yorick actually in episode 3 that we had to do entirely CG that was kind of a fairly late addition. And I just think it came out well in that it sits in there and you don't feel like you're watching a fully 3D everything.
Yeah.
Like the environment, you know, I think came out really well. And I really love in episode, I guess it's this episode, isn't it? When Mrs. Coulter and the monkey and the killing the witch or spectering the witch.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was fun for a number of reasons. Partly because me and Jamie Childs, the director, we really riffed on that scene. We went out for dinner one night and we were thinking about that scene, and you know, because with all these things you're trying to work out where to place it amongst the sets and things that you have. And we were like, what if we did this, what if we did that, what if we did this, and suddenly it changed from sort of one thing into like, you know, same script, same outline, but a different setup. And then the way it came out in the end, I think, is really, really grim. So I like it.
Grim is right. Yeah, yes, we'll get into that in a bit. But it is it's a great example of what you said you're most proud of, which is that demon character work and telling us what the demon's informing us about somebody's character. Which
I think what's been really interesting actually this year, social media wise, for me. Is actually this year there's been a lot more commentary on the understanding of what the demons are representing from the general audience, which I'm really pleased about. You know, when I see people going, oh, Mrs. Coulter really isn't happy with herself, or be kind to yourself, Marissa, like comments like that, they're the things that make me the happiest, because it means that we're flavouring it correctly.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So it's good, yeah.
I mean, her relationship with her demon in particular, I feel like everybody, you know, the demons always give you something. But with her, what's going on inside is so diametrically opposed usually to what she's showing on her face that it gives you so much more depth to her character. It's astonishing.
Yeah, it's really key and central to what she does. And, you know, again, it's, you know, it's partly because Ruth embraced it so much. And it's also because it's such... I don't want to say it's easy fodder, because it isn't, but it's just so ripe for the picking, if you know what I mean, which I think is really cool. Like when you have those scenes and you kind of, you realize that, there's an analogy that I would make for how my brain works when I read Mrs. Coulter scenes. And it's like when I watch The Crown, strange reference,
okay,
but when I watch The Crown, especially season one of The Crown, I'm like, it's the perfect setup. It's like the woman versus the job. It's great. Mm-hmm. It's like it you can always play this thing and it's always going to have really great underlying tension. And with Mrs. Coulter, it's the woman versus herself.
Yeah.
And it's always there. So you can choose to go into it or you can choose not to. A lot of the time, in all honesty, Ruth does it all by just looking at people and you kind of go, whoa, I get it. You know, you know. So sometimes you're like, do we need the monkey at all? Should we just sack it off, get rid of it? Ruth's doing a great job on her own. But it's really fun. It's really fun stuff to explore. And, you know, and there's something about making a villainous, you know, it's like you've got two villains that you feel for and despise equally at opposite times, but they're the same person.
Yeah.
That's exactly how I feel about that monkey.
Yeah, it's cool. It's good. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, and the monkey in the seatbelt was adorable at the same time. So you've got, you know, you've got these moments where you're like, oh, look at the monkey.
It's amazing what road safety can do to people's hearts, isn't it?
that is my one key takeaway. That monkey in the seatbelt, and also Lord Boreal launching his snake demon at Will, which I'll never forget. Did you guys animate that?
Or
did one of your team sit at a computer for 6 hours?
Yeah, yeah.
And animating a snake flying out of a man's wrist.
The highlight of it was actually when we were on set and we were putting a little proxy sausage up his sleeve for him to release, so that it sort of moved the cloth a little bit as he released the snake onto the floor in a very sort of laissez-faire way, I'd have to say, actually.
Fire the sausage, Arian.
And what's annoying is, you know, like you do that and, you know, from a supervision perspective, like you sort of say, we're going to give you this thing to help you. And then the first three times it doesn't work and you feel like such an idiot. And you're like, and it's like, it's not you, it's me. You
know what I mean? And he's like, Russell, my sausage launcher is broken.
Exactly. That's pretty much the highlight of the job.
My God. Yeah. Excellent.
I'm sorry, sausage launcher has broken me. That sounds vaguely wrong. Should we talk about this episode then? Should we go through it a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
And start with, well, the episode starts with a witch. It starts with Rudiscadi, who is, I wasn't sure initially when I watched it where she was, but then I guess it sort of links up to the Azrael scene later. So she's presumably on her way to, or on her way back from,
she's in Mordor.
Conferring with him.
Hmm? Yeah, she's in Mordor.
She's in Mordor by way of the Giant's Causeway.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You got it. I mean, it's sort of, it's part of that idea of how you keep Asriel alive in the viewer's mind, you know, mm-hmm. as a thing that's still continuing, like his quest is still happening in the background. And, you know, again, it's tricky that. It's really strange in a way that it's not in the second book more, mm-hmm. because it's kind of, you know, it's all about having that sort of multiple ticking clocks all colliding, right, when you're trying to make sort of stories. So you realise there's this thing that you're just not paying attention to that actually adds this sort of underlying sort of pulse. So I think having those references are good. I also think that you really need to start warming the viewer up for season three, like how right. it's a bit bonkers.
Yeah.
You know, so I think it's not great if you don't go a bit more fantasy and then you go full fantasy yeah. the next season, you know. So I think it was really useful to have it in. Again, it was one of those scenes where we were like, where should we put it? Which episode should it sit in? Should we do it? Should we not do it? You know, it was one of those scenes. But yeah, I think it came out quite nicely, actually. Mm.
So, yeah, the design of the cliff ghast was quite cool. How did all that come about?
They sort of carried on from the first season. It's just obviously we see them a bit more. They're just those sort of fun characters, you know. You kind of reference some real world animals, you reference a bat for the way their little leathery wings are, you make them move a bit awkwardly and a bit weird, try and keep them animalistic so they're not too, you know. It's like trying to find that balance between something feeling like a character and something feeling like an animal, and you want them to feel slightly more on the side of an animal than on the side of a pure character.
And it's
also giving, you know, again, putting the witches in kind of slightly cool situations, because you want to heighten the witches so that you feel like they are otherworldly. They're not just in a wood having a chat all the time.
they chat a lot.
They chat a lot.
The poor old witches have to deliver all the prophecies and the exposition in this show. Bless them.
Yeah, it is tricky. It is tricky, but hey.
Yeah. Well, at least technically the cliff ghasts deliver some exposition here. So, you know, the witch just listens and passes it on later. So really,
exactly.
It's sharing it out.
As soon as the this word popped up in the subtitles, I realized I've never heard it spoken out loud before. Because, you know, you just read a book and in your own head you say Ashishtar, and then I was like, so Asriel needs the Ashishtar, and then I was just like, please somebody speak this in English later so I know how to say it. And I still don't know how to say it. Ashitar?
It's tricky for you. It's going to be hard for you, isn't it, going forwards? Let's leave it a mystery.
Russell, I've spent this whole season trying to figure out how to say Chittagazi, and I think I'm nearly there.
But you need to give it a little flourish at the end. Don't be shy of the Chittagazi.
Chittagazi.
Sort of add a T in between the Zs. It'll be fine.
Right, okay.
And we call the knife the Asa Hetra.
Thank you. There you go. See, this is why we need the big guns here. Asa Hetra.
Yes. So Asriel will lose if he doesn't have it, apparently.
Apparently.
And also we get this sort of statement of intent, I guess, that his war is going to be bigger than just the Magisterium. It's going to be in every world. Agents of the Authority are committing injustices. So this has gone from let's bring down the government to let's change the universe, essentially.
Yeah, thank you, Philip Pullman. I think that's really nice, though. I think what's great is that idea of, you know, Asriel's quest is one, it's not singular. You know, it's like, you know, at the beginning, he thinks he opens the worlds, he proves to everybody that the Magisterium are full of it, done. And then he goes through and he's like, oh, wait a minute, there's this whole other level of oppression in every world. And there's this whole, you know, and how, you know, and how all that over time then connects with dust is going to be really, really interesting, you know. And I think that I like the idea of someone who has a sort of like an onward journey and learns things that pushes their quest forward, because it means that it reinforces his character. His character isn't someone who goes, I'm going to perform this job. He is someone that goes on quests and he always will find a quest. And if this wasn't his quest, he'd be like building like the hardest IKEA shelving system or something. Do you know what I mean? He'd always have a mission, that man. And I think that I think it's good that, you know, he learns about things and keeps going, you know. So yeah, it's good.
Should we keep with the witches? Because Rudiskadi then comes back a little bit later in the episode, recognises Lyra, meets with Serafina, and their conference seemed quite important. So they have this kind of... it's an kind of uneasy alliance, it feels like. Like, Serafina holds back some information there, it seems to me. Mm. And about the Asahetra. Asahetra.
It's like you get extra, you get extra points if you can slightly roll the R at the end.
Oh, I definitely can't. But yeah, Seraphine is slightly holding back and saying, okay, if that is the mission, Lyra is still key to that because of this prophecy. Therefore, you go off and help Azrael and I'll be like here looking after the kid.
Yeah, you've got two very different characters really between Seraphine and Ruta. You've got someone who is very immediate in Ruta. You know, I think, and that's part of the reason why it was such, I think, such a good call to switch her out from Serafina for the opening scene when she attached the submarine, because it's a, you know, when you introduce a new character, you need to, it's really good to give them like a vibe, basically. And I think giving her that that action straight away and giving her that very kind of, you know, sort of functional sort of presence in a way, she's like, I'm going to kill these people, and she just does it. So you've got two very different characters, because you've got, she sees the problem. She's a bit more like Azrael, actually, in that she sees the problem and she's just going to go for it. And that's why, you know, I guess that her and Azrael, I think, in the books have some sort of history, don't they? And then Serafina is sort of like more, she sort of plays the long game a bit more, I think. And she's more, a bit more, I don't want to say cerebral, but she's more, I've just said it. Too late, Russ. But you know, as in, like, she is aware of this prophecy about Lyra. And the hardest thing about Lyra and that prophecy is that Lyra isn't allowed to know what it is. You know, it's all about, it's really funny. It's a bit like, you know, the thing with the alethiometer is like, it tells you what will happen, what will happen if certain events take place. And it's almost like as soon as you learn too much, it starts to change what you're going to do, which is why I think it's interesting. Like, Lyra's relationship with that is kind of interesting. So I think, you know, yeah, Serafina has always in the back of her mind, she's trying to like work out this political issue with Ruta, which is about whether her people go to war, whether they don't go to war, and making sure that the mission doesn't become so one way that it isn't also taking care of Lyra, which is actually the underlying, you know, thing that she thinks is the most important.
Yeah.
It's like they both have the same objective, but different methods.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
what's interesting is you've got other characters such as Mrs. Coulter, with kind of a different objective, but the same method, which is protect Lyra. And then you've Lee also trying, like, you've all these characters trying to protect Lyra because they understand her importance, but each with a completely different perspective on why they're protecting Lyra and how you go about
and
it.
And how you protect Lyra, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, stick her in a box at the end. So it's one way to protect
that,
someone.
That would work, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the I think, you know, I always sort of view Lyra as like, you know, like how the president has the nuclear football that everyone has to protect. I see her as that. Like, it doesn't quite know what its job is, but everyone is making it do the thing that it needs to do. Yeah, and I think I really love that about the show. Like, I love the idea of, you know, there's someone who's kind of got this destiny and everybody is just sort of patting them into the right sort of place to allow things to occur.
Yeah.
You know, and you get that from the angels as well, the idea that the angels have interfered in human, you know, humanity over time. Like, this idea of, you know, guidance is interesting.
I think it's important as well, because a lot of you know, kids fantasy books and fantasy books in general have a chosen one who is prophesized to do the thing and sort out the stuff, and, you know, it can feel improbable even beyond the realm of, you know, suspending disbelief sometimes when they appear to just do all these things on their own and things just happen to work out for them, whereas in this case you have large numbers of people who are motivated in different ways at different times to try to help out, and I think that really helps with the believability of the whole worlds in this book.
I mean, Lyra is a very grounded heroine. So, yeah, so like Lyra, I think, has two sort of superpowers. One of them is the ability to kind of clear her mind and be open to ideas, which is that connection to the alethiometer. And you learn that with sort of Mary and the I Ching and, you know,
and
all of
cave,
that. All of,
and, yeah.
And the cave, you know. And I think that's a big part of Pullman's sort of, like, I don't know what the right word is, like, thesis or idea, is that, you know, like, that in youth there is an openness and a willingness to accept and engage and imagine, and they're all really important qualities, and everything is, you know, and life as we know it is somehow all about beating that out of you, and it's about trying to keep hold of it, right? And I think that, so I think you know, that's a, like, you know, what a great superpower. right? It's not like she can't fly. It's none of that stuff. It's just that she can clear her mind and accept something, you know? Mm. And the other superpower is she's just good. She wants to do good, even when, you know, faced, you know, I think, I can't remember the way Jane Tranter puts it, but it's that idea that she isn't great. It's just she does great things through being good.
Right.
You know, and that is, it's not that we've got a character that is great. She is good. And the result is greatness. Mm. You know,
she also, and she also feels like she can fail. And
yeah.
And back to sort of Helen's point, your point about other fantasy properties and prophecies and destiny. I think what I like about this show is that the Serafina is constantly reminding us that the prophecy is not set. It's something that needs to be, you know, shepherded, like you guys were saying. She needs to be guided. Mm. Otherwise, it won't happen. Because if it's just predestination, then you take out that agency and you take out the threat a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the stakes aren't there if it's not that it, you know. I mean, I can't remember what the actual final prophecy is that Kaiser says at the beginning in like episode 4 of season 1, but he says if something happens it will all fail. Like there is a huge potential for failure, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, the thing that's interesting with the way Pullman writes is there's every chance that it ends with failure. I mean, Roger dies at the end of the first season.
Yeah.
You know, that is, you know, you could see that as a failure of some form, you know. It's like, and that's the way a season ends.
Yeah, and Lyra sees it that way. Like Lyra, exactly. That is, as far as she's concerned, that was devastating, and that was, you know, she's determined nothing like that will ever happen again.
Exactly.
Which we keep hearing this time with her and Will. Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of trying to protect children,
I'm going to segue onto
Mary and her quest for returning the lost children to their parents. Don't worry, it's complete. She did it.
Yeah.
Straight away.
Good job. Good job.
What's on the cutting room floor here, Russell? Is there an awesome side quest where Mary and these kids... they just walked up the hill?
No, I mean, you know, that is a classic example of, you know, there is no... You know, you could do a whole thing with her and, you know, there's always that thing in the book which is like, why doesn't she get attacked by spectres? And it's just sort of hinted that she's protected by angels, basically, which is the same thing that we did.
Yeah.
It's not. It's just a representation of who she is. That's all it is.
Yeah,
it's two things. It's a bit like, first thing is, if you go into another world, I mean, I guess it has served two functions actually. If you go into another world and there's absolutely nothing but really inhospitable mountains and then a really big city, you're probably not going to leave the city for quite a while. It gets her out of the city, right? And it gets her to the place where she can find a window through to somewhere else, right? So it helps us. It helps us, and in the book, it gets her on a journey, which is the beginning of her onward journey, which everybody sort of has. And it shows us that she's decent, you know. It's like she's got this quest, she's been told she's great, but she'll stop to go and help a couple of kids out.
Yeah,
you know. And I love, and to be honest, I mean, like, I am a huge fan of Simone, who plays Mary Malone. Like, when she turned up, I was like, yes, that's Mary Malone, right? Yeah. I think she's brilliant. And she plays that kind of, she's so natural the way she plays the character. And I remember watching in the rushes, watching that scene when like one of the kids just asks her for a hug. And I think those two kids are really good.
Really good,
They're really good. It's a great scene. So it's like really touching, really sweet. And it's just quite subtly played. But yeah, you know. So I think that's what it serves. There's no like missing action sequence where she's like punching a spectre in the mouth.
that's just me and my hunger for more. Just more spectre punching.
I just love Mary in these two episodes, because everybody else is going around with these incredibly high stakes, high emotion, you know, really like acting their little hearts out, and she's basically just having a nice wander around a sunny city and just touristing a little bit.
She's just sitting on the steps doing some sort of slightly sort of esoteric Chinese sort of spiritual medicine type thing, or whatever it is, the I Ching, you know. She's just sort of sitting there like, I don't know. So I know. So it's like the place where people have been dying in other episodes, and she's just sort of chilling out.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's cool.
She's just chilling out, reading a book. Yeah. And we get to... So yeah, last week was the Bible. This week it's I Ching. And she says, the fox, after nearly crossing the stream, gets his tail in the water. I think that's...
I think we're all clear on what that means.
Yeah.
So moving
100%, 100%.
on. Yeah, we're all familiar with that one.
Yeah, classic proverb.
I genuinely don't have much to say. I mean, I've read the books. I don't remember what she's even alluding to here.
I don't know what that was either.
Yeah, I don't think we see exactly that in the books, because she sort of relates all of this, spoiler, later, I think. She doesn't necessarily... We don't necessarily see all this as it happens.
I think it does feel important.
Yeah.
Yeah. The only thing that you really get from this is the idea of, like, you know, there's two readings she does. One when she's on the bed, which is about the kind of the idea of opening your mind up, and then the second one is about getting to a mountain, getting to a summit.
Yeah.
Which ties in with what she's doing later.
Mm. Yeah. Tell me about the landscape here, by the way. Like, where did you get this landscape? Because it didn't look like Wales. So I assume that was...
You haven't been to Wales enough.
Apparently not, no.
There's a bit in the middle that's really amazing like that. No, so we went to... what was interesting, so the production designer, Joel Collins, when he did all of his early concepts, he always had Chittagatse surrounded by sort of really crazy mountainscapes that were inspired more by sort of Guilin in China.
Oh, okay.
But what we wanted is we wanted them coming out of the sea.
Right.
And then our VFX producer, James Whitlam, he had at some point... fortunately been on holiday to Kauai, which is one of the smaller islands of Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And they have this place, this coastline, the Nepali coast, which is these beautiful kind of ribbon mountains that come out of the straight out of the sea. So unfortunately I had to go to Kauai and film all that
stuff. Poor thing.
Sorry.
Times are hard. So I sort of went out there. I went out there for about a week. I did 2 days of helicopter shooting, mm-hmm. Which sounds wonderful, but like 3 weeks before, 7 people had died in a helicopter where we were flying, and or something like that. And then, like, the day that I got there, Kobe Bryant died in a helicopter. So I was like, hopefully that's all the bad luck out of the way.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah. So we did like a couple of days of helicopter shooting, which was amazing. That place is so beautiful. And then we did 2 or 3 days on the ground. We filmed some kind of plates that we might use that we actually... We used some of them in Lyra's journey down to Chittagatse at the beginning of the first episode.
Right.
And then we shot a lot of photography that allows us to build out things like that Mary Malone landscape, because that's actually just her standing on a small blue screen.
Yeah.
When she takes the kids, Joel Collins built a set that is that kind of maze that they're walking through, that kind of crack in the ground maze. And then it had an opening at one end that they open up to. And then, we extended all of that with the references. Yeah.
Cool. Wow.
Awesome.
Tough job, man. Tough job. Well done.
It is really hard.
If you're listening to this podcast, you must recognize the value of asking questions. At Aramco, our questions help us engineer a better future. How can today's resources fuel our shared tomorrow? How can we deliver energy to a world that can't stop? How can we deliver one of the fuels of the future? How can we sow curiosity to harvest ingenuity? To learn more about how innovation drives us forward, visit aramco.com/poweredbyhow.
Will we chat a bit about Mrs. Coulter and her pet specters? So we start the episode with Mrs. Coulter finding Lyra and Will's house, and we get this really interesting, touching moment where she's picks up Lyra's coat and just is kind of just inhaling her scent, and it's this brilliant reminder that she has, you know, a mission and an objective, but it's also just this personal longing for her child, which again also feels at odds with everything else we see her do often.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's what I like about her character is that's like, I always say that it's like she's got like two strands, really. I think, I mean, she's got like her kind of quest, which changes, you know, it sort of, you know, and you see it change in this show. She's like, her quest is to kind of get more control within the Magisterium, get Father MacPhail into this position. Then suddenly she learns that Lyra's in another world and she's like, see you later. And then she's out, you know, and she goes on a new quest. And I think there's that. And then I think the other thing that I love is that it's the whole three books is like her reawakening and like finding love. Right, and that's both love for Lyra and sort of coming to terms with it, and for herself to a degree.
Yeah,
you know, or finding comfort in just being. And I think that you know, she obviously plays that brilliantly. So I think those little touches, like, you know, when she's smelling the jacket, they just sort of throw you back in, and it's just like another little thing that's adding on top to this sort of very slow progressive journey of dysfunctional parenting.
It really is. I was interested. It's actually the monkey that finds the house, not her. I thought that was a really nice little touch.
Oh, yeah.
So she's about to walk straight past and he goes in and is like, oh.
Yeah, it's like, it's an inner sense. Mm. You know, it's like, yeah, it's like a, it's a, it's that kind of visual representation of like a feeling of a hunch. Mm. You know, it's good. It's really nice.
Really
and
good.
I like, you know, again, those little scenes with the monkey, I love them. Like, they're the ones that I really like doing. Because it's like, how do you get that kind of right amount of pace that it's not creepy, but it feels sort of gentle?
Mm.
And then, you know, 2 minutes later, it's moving at about the same rate, but it's terrifying. So
terrifying. Because we should talk about the witch coming into the city. So, you know, they've seen that there is a human from their world with a demon wandering around. God bless them. They want to warn this person and help them out. And that turns out to be
just
huge mistake.
Massive mistake.
That poor woman. Yes. So she really did not know who she was messing with in this respect. That's it.
Yeah, and I think I love that she has so much power, Mrs. Coulter. Like, you know, I think what, you know, the way they played that scene, that the witch suddenly realizes she's in the presence of something a bit evil.
Yeah.
And it sort of grows. It's sort of like that suspicion grows very quickly, which I think is really kind of interesting and cool.
Mm.
She has that presence, you know. I love that sequence. It's really dark, obviously. But there's something I really love about the idea, especially at the end when she like just sort of teases the monkey by putting the spectre right up close to it, like she's going to spectre herself. It's sort of like, again, it's that kind of slight, you know, it's the same as in season one when she steps on the balcony and she's walking on the balcony, she's toying with her life a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, it's that same instinct that she has. It's that kind of slightly self-destructive instinct. I think it's a really great visual representation of it. And that's one of the things, again, that's what came out of us sort of riffing on the idea of that scene.
Mm.
And I think my favourite part of the scene is the end when you get the unexpected return of the spectre. And it's, I love that. I absolutely love that.
Yeah, I mean, kudos to you guys. You communicate so much with, you know, visually, like there's very, you know, besides we do have an exchange of dialogue and a very important one in which the witch finally reveals the name that we've been teasing. So she is Eve.
Mm-hmm.
But all those little touches that you reference, Russell, are so interesting. And the even what's happening with the monkey attacking this witch's demon and this little exchange, like this fear, the fear of the monkey as the spectre approaches. And then this sort of, you know, this looking away and kind of almost offering this demon up as a sacrifice. And all of that is happening while she is physically grappling with this demon. And then this horrific moment when the witch's eyes go vacant. Actually, it's really chilling stuff. It's hard. Again, real horror vibes throughout this whole season.
And it's that perfect sort of thing of like, it's the collision of lots of conflicting emotion.
Mm.
Right. That's why it's really good. It's like, so the monkey is... like it's I guess it's that unpredictable thing. So you've got this monkey is like, I am team Mrs. Coulter, I'm gonna go and I'm gonna get that bird for you, and it jumps up and it gets the alarmingly complicated bird to animate, by the way.
What kind of bird is this?
I think it's the only time a Chinese pond heron has ever been made in CGI.
Wow.
And it turns out that they are an absolute bitch to do. They're like really hard, because they've got like a really stretchy neck. That's why we picked it, because we picked a bird that could be grabbed by the neck.
Oh, right.
We basically picked it for that scene.
So I presume you went out to a Chinese pond for 6 weeks.
100%, 100%.
Research. 100%. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I dressed up as one, became friends with them, communed with the herons. Actually, there's only like two or three reference pictures we could find of them. They're like super rare. But anyway, I like the fact that the monkey is like totally team Coulter. They're like, yes, we're doing this. And then it jumps over and then it attacks it. And then he's like, yeah, I've got it. And then the spectre turns up and he's like, wait a minute, what? And he's like, what are we doing? I thought we were doing the thing we did in season one where I beat it up and you do the thing. But now there's this new guy. And then, and I really like that, you know, we got some really nice details in there. Like we really wanted to get, you know, like there's little things that I love, like the monkey's holding the heron down, and he's got pinning his down with his paws or his
hands, I guess. And then the spectre approaches, and that makes the monkey lose focus on the demon for a sec, and his hand lifts up, and then the heron slaps him in the face with his wing, and he pushes it back down in a frustrated way. Like, it's little details like that that, you know, we spend a lot of time working on, because we're like, you know, that actually, that exact moment is something that this is going to sound ridiculous, but for me, that is referenced from The Thin Red Line, where there's a bit where there's a guy, and there's a scene in The Thin Red Line where you've got a soldier and he's walking through really tall bamboo grass, really tall, long grass, and they find a bunch of their troops dead, like really horribly dead. And he's in this place with these tall vines, and he tries to turn around, and his backpack gets caught on the vines, and it's this moment of frustration, right? That when I watched it, I was like, I know that feeling. I love that they put that in the film. So anytime I can sort of like find with animation like a conflicting feeling or sensation or emotion that is taking you out of the moment where you're meant to be present in, I really love. So that, just that slap in the face for me, is just me going back to the fact that I love that reference in Thin Red Line. Totally weird sidebar, sorry.
Amazing movie, so you know.
Yeah, love it. Yeah, absolutely brilliant. So we could talk about that one time.
That'd be good.
It's those little details I like, and I love the fact that you notice the fact that he holds it up, and it's both an offering and like a last hope. Like, the monkey is like, I don't know if this is where we spectre ourselves.
Yep.
Because she's mental. So I'm going to hold this thing up and hope that this is what you want, and I'm going to look away because I don't want to know what the result is. You know? And I love that.
The monkey's scared. It comes across like it's...
Yeah,
it's
terrified.
And
then, so interesting.
And then you think it's over, and then she gives it another little fear again, which I like.
Yeah. And then just visibly grabs control of herself and calms the monkey, and therefore the spectre leaves. Like, it just, like, it's gorgeous, gorgeous the moment that. But then they still have almost that face-off underneath the tower. You know, there's this sort of moment of silent defiance or something, and a sort of restatement of their mission. Like, it's sort of like, okay, we disagree on certain things, but we can agree on protecting Lyra, essentially. It's a really interesting scene to play out with only one voice available.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great thing that I like about what we've done over the second season, and Ruth's done particularly well, is in season two, her and the monkey are at odds a lot.
Yeah.
You know, there's just things, you know, like, you can go through every episode and there's some kind of collision of like what they both feel they want to be doing. You know, like when Lee and Mrs. Coulter are having their jail cell.
Oh, yeah.
Sort of great scene. Great
face
scene.
Off. You know, that's really lovely, because there's that moment where, like, you know, again, the monkey thinks it knows where they're at. It's got Hester around the neck. And it's like, you know, it's sort of like, I always think of the monkey as the guy in a bank heist movie who starts shooting people when that was the plan was not to shoot people. So he's like, we're going to go. And he grabs the thing around the neck. And then Mrs. Coulter changes the plan. And then the monkey has this look of like, what, you know? And so it's always like this kind of disconnect between them. And I think that scene you're talking about at the end in eight, when Mrs. Coulter and the monkey kind of, it's in the book when they, you know, like, it says the monkey climbs up onto a rock, because at that point Mrs. Coulter in the book is walking through the countryside, and it stops, and Mrs. Coulter turns around and says, you know, you're with me or not. And yeah, I thought, again, I really loved I loved the way Ruth kicks the monkey. I think it's great. Like, gives it a proper boot up the ass. I really like it.
It's horrible, because she's, and then she goes and comforts it and strokes it.
And then
it's an abusive relationship, isn't it?
Yeah, and we get to have the monkey kind of want the love but be scared of the opposite.
Yeah.
And it's that sort of unpredictability of, you know, her sort of psychological state that is really good sort of TV, isn't it?
It really is.
Well, it's a very familiar, like, textbook abusive relationship, but like with one's self. That is just endlessly fascinating.
Like The Crown again, I guess.
Exactly.
But it's interesting as well. So she says this, I think, in the scene with the witch, actually, before that kind of confrontation. But once Lyra's identified as Eve, she says it's Eve before the fall. This time she mustn't fall. I'll see to that. So, you know, well, that's kind of a large aim, Mrs. Coulter. Good luck with that. But it does sort of explain to some extent why she then does what she does, which is to literally put her kid in a box. rather than risk...
Put the kid in a box?
Yeah, that's what I keep having in my sure head as well. I'm sorry.
No, that's the...
I'm not sure you're allowed to do that.
No. Yeah. Very, very, very inappropriate.
Yeah, I regret that.
But yeah, I guess it does explain exactly why she's doing what she's doing, if she's literally worried about the fall of mankind, I suppose. I think it might come back to... it might come back to her, you know, slightly... maybe not divided loyalties, but her affection is the wrong word, her allegiance to the magisterium, and her there is
and
a sense that she has a bit more
beliefs,
has a bit more belief in that system maybe than Azrael, for example.
Again, it's that and it's hard, it's also hard to know. It's kind of like, you know, as soon as she finds out that Lyra's potential destiny becomes this huge deal, suddenly you have the magisterium wanting to stop her.
Yeah.
So it's also a protective instinct. She's like, if I let this happen, then everybody is going to be going after her.
Yeah.
So I think it's really hard, and I think that's what I like about that, is it's quite ambiguous what her motivations and intentions are, and then we get season three hopefully to flesh that out and really get into it, because it's really exciting stuff. And I think there's a lot... I think the thing is I think as an audience, the show is really tricky. It's a very tricky show to really get a handle on, I think. I mean, it's so hard to structurally make when there's so many threads and so many big ideas and so many characters. It's very complex stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, just how kind of Dust, you know, the Fall of Eve, and how all of these things collide, connect and become logical... is really exciting. I think it's really interesting. It's what's exciting about doing the third book, is it's a challenge in that way.
It's a very big challenge in that way. No spoilers, but like it's enormous. It's huge. Yeah.
Indeed.
Sorry, I shouldn't be hyping it up to you. It'll be fine. You'll be fine. No problem.
No, tell me the truth.
Does that? I mean, you must get. It is a challenge and it's probably exciting, but there must be moments in this where they keep in this series where all the characters are referencing this great war that's coming, and when that happens, do you on a professional level just think, oh my fucking god, like
yeah, I die inside.
I gotta make that.
I do and I don't, because well, I mean. Visually, the thing that's hard is the storytelling. That's what's hard. Like, you know, if you throw enough talent and enough time and enough money, you can pretty much make anything, you know. It's just about how you do it well, because, you know, we are not a show that is going to do like a massive Marvel or Star Wars battle sequence for 25 minutes, for 30 minutes, you know. I don't think that's... I mean, I could be wrong. And if we do, it will be from a point of view that is important.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like we try not to just disappear up, you know, the visual effects. I can't say that word now.
the big blue beam in the sky.
Exactly. We try not try not to do it, because I think we've done it before, everybody's seen it before, and you lose what's important about the story, which is the journey of characters.
I think as well, I mean, the books almost don't do it. Like, there are giant wars happening, but our characters are not usually in the middle of those conflicts. They're usually off doing their own thing.
Well, that's a distracting thing, isn't it, about the books?
Yeah.
Like, I know in the beginning of... I can't say in the beginning of book three. There's a lot of times where, like, there's a battle happening, but you're indoors.
Exactly.
you know.
Or someone reports back that a battle has happened, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, because the battle, I think, and that's what I really like about Pullman's writing, is that the detail is in what people believe and their characters. It's not in whether or not, like, a spaceship blew up another spaceship, you know, which I like.
And it's funny, because I really like that approach, and as an audience, you kind of hunger to see the thing, you know, you hunger to see these big battles, and but actually it is kind of empty calories at the end of the day. And what we really do want and engage with is character and emotion. I think approach is wise.
I always look back to the old Ray Harryhausen films, you know, where you've got, like, you know, they had no choice but to be point of view. They had no choice but to be with Sinbad,
yeah,
or whatever, or Jason, you know, and There was no, like, we'll go off and do a visual effects extravaganza.
Because there just wouldn't have been enough hours in the day,
And also, it's like, you know, we can't move the camera like that. We can't do this. There's too many limitations. Mm. But actually, those limitations make it good. Mm. Like, you've just got these, like, you're always with him. You're always experiencing him under some stress or threat.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what makes it good. It's point of view. Yeah. So, you know.
Some really interesting references coming out in this episode, Russell.
Yeah, sorry, it's all
No,
it's off the hip.
Thin Red Line was a real surprise.
Yeah, well, there you go.
So what about this box? Like, is she still in the world of Chittagatse at that point, or is she back in her own world? That's one thing I wasn't entirely clear on.
I'm not entirely clear either.
Okay.
What we know is they're on a journey, and we'll pick them up. Again, in the book, it's a little hazy, you know, like where she ends up at the beginning of book three, you're like, what? How did that happen?
How did the
what? You know?
Yeah.
Exactly. So,
my personal sense, I don't know the answer either, but it seemed Coulter had an outfit change. So I feel like she's gone back to her wardrobe somehow. So it felt like she did a circuitous route through her own house, picked up a spare outfit, packed a bag. Dragging a box the whole time.
In my mind, she's in the sea in Lyra's world. That's how I view it.
It's
just that
we don't
show
that journey, so therefore, you know, you can take what you like from it, I guess.
Fair enough.
And it does feel like this whole idea, her mission is, as we've said, you know, protect Lyra, prevent the fall. But it is, the approach is this, you know, as you said, Russell, this dysfunctional parenting. Mm. It's this, you know, I'm going to stick my child in a box, literally, but also metaphorically, I'm going to prevent any outside influence, you know, it's this overbearing, protective, parental attitude to a child who's going through a personal and change and experience, and it's just like, you know, that doesn't work.
The whole thing with, the whole book is about control, isn't it? The whole trilogy is about like control and fighting the people that try and control you. You know, it's a big one of the massive threads or the sort of morals of the book. So yeah, Mrs. Coulter is trying to control the uncontrollable, which is a teenage girl. You know, I think anybody watching that finds it kind of laughable that that's what she's doing. You know, like the idea, I've got to stop this young girl falling in love with this boy. In that case, I'm going to put him in a box.
Maybe they're taking the wrong lesson away from it. People are watching this being like, why hadn't I thought of that?
Exactly. Or they're comforted because their child is in a box. Yeah. And they're like, see, she does it too.
Fine. Totally fine. Speaking of control, Mrs. Coulter and the Spectres. Now, you said that the Spectres were kind of difficult to get right, to conceive of. What was the kind of journey with them? What were you trying to get across?
So they're quite tricky in the book. Like the way they're described, you know, they're quite hard to get like a handle on what they look and feel like. And you know, the whole idea that like some people can see them and some people can't is really hard in TV. Really hard. You have to kind of do it again through like point of view, but then you're like, is the audience going to pick up on that, or are they going to be confused? It's a bit like we had the first reveal of a Spectre properly at the end of the first episode, coming up behind Will, and everyone's like, why didn't we go back to the bit when Will had the monster behind him? But it's because, you know, they can't see them, which we've said earlier. I think we said earlier.
Yeah, you did. Yeah.
You know, it's just a tough sell. We also knew that we didn't want them to be human and ghost-like. We knew we wanted them to be impartial, in that they don't like have people that they want to attack. It's just if you're near them, they'll go for you.
Right.
You know, they're more of an organism than a monster per se. And then we knew that we had to be very careful not to get too close to the number of already really brilliant effects monsters that exist. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the hard thing. It's like, what you need is an effects monster, but there's lots of effects monsters. The things that we did, we made sure they didn't have a front and a back particularly.
Right.
They don't particularly have like the idea of a head, right? They're just like a thing that floats around. We made them both kind of particle-y in that they can break apart.
Yeah.
But we made them that when they connect, they just sort of become like a larger thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we did have designs which would have been in, I think, the missing episode where you see that they can kind of, two of them can become like one bigger one and things like that.
Oh, wow.
But
Like the Spice Girls.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's the reference that this episode required. Thank you for bringing it home. So we kind of knew that we knew the things we wanted to avoid. And we knew there were certain things, like, for example, Jane Tranter, she was the one who said, I don't want them to feel like they've got a front or a back. I want them to feel like just an organism. And she said she doesn't want them to be black.
Right.
She wants them to be grey because they're kind of this kind of hopeless, vacuous kind of, you know, is vacuous the right word? They're like a vacuum of hope, a vacuum of hope or whatever.
And it might get too dementory, I guess.
Exactly. Now, the problem is what happens when you have something grey and it's in a dark room? It goes black. So and then if you have something grey and it's in like sunlight, it kind of goes a bit orange. So that proved quite tricky. And then I think the other thing, I mean, this is where it gets a little technical, but you've got kind of two ways when you create creatures. You either create a creature as like a tangible asset that you have like a way of moving it and it's very, very predictable. Mm-hmm. But getting to that point with an effects monster is very, very time consuming. Mm. Yeah. And we had a very fast turnaround on our schedule. And the other way is that you do them procedurally, which is where you basically use maths and procedural kind of simulations to create them. And what you get is you get loads of really cool stuff that looks cool. You get loads of really interesting happy accidents, but they're really unpredictable. So what you do is you put them in a shot and you go, looks great. And then you put the same thing in the next shot with the same settings and you go, looks terrible. That's the thing that what kept me up at night is whether or not the guys who were being kept up at night by the spectres were going to nail it, you know. And they did, but it wasn't easy. And that scene when Mrs. Coulter controls them was probably the hardest of them, because, you know, when you design a creature that moves a lot and then you have a scene when they don't move much, and then you're like, well, what makes them look like they're staying in the air? Like, how do they move when they're not moving?
And if they don't have a front and a back, how do you make it look like they're paying attention, kind of thing?
Exactly. Yeah. And so all of these like challenges are really interesting. You know, like what does one look like when it's just, if it's just in the air, it's just sort of evolving on itself. Mm. You know, it's sort of like just churning. And, you know, you don't want it to look too much like water, but you don't want it to look too much like oil. So there's this, yeah, they were really, really, really tricky. Mm. But I think they came out quite cool.
Oh, yeah. Very scary.
I think the best the best compliment you can give in this instance is that I wasn't thinking about any of those things when I was watching them, and I was just like, yeah, floaty specters, floaty scary specters.
good. Job done.
So yeah. will we chat a bit about Lee and the Joe Paree and the quest to get out of the forest and away from the bullets?
It was interesting, I thought, that this was in a forest and not the sort of like bleak mountainside of the books. I mean, I guess it gives you a little bit more lushness to the scene in this one.
Yeah, I mean, you set up, you know, first of all, we'd set up a landscape and an environment. And we, you know, the other thing with the show is sort of having a sense of idea of where people are. Mm. Like, it's really useful if you can be like, they're in the town and I can see the town, but I'm establishing a shot that's sort of here, but the town's in the background. So you know that they've walked and they journeyed, and then the other thing is we really, really like the location that we found, which was Lydney Wood,
right?
And it's really, really nice, and it's sort of like it had like this kind of gulchy sort of vibe, but yeah, it offered us sort of some lushness, and I think there's something nice about that. I think it's very easy to go down the route of it's a really barren, depressing landscape where the person gets in a gunfight, but actually it's quite nice that it's in quite a pretty place, and it sort of suits Lee when he's, you know, not no longer sort of with us, that he's in like this kind of almost like a glade sort of situation. It's quite nice.
Yeah, it's beautiful. But they're being pursued by the Magisterium. We see the Zeppelin. It was actually only on the second view that I actually saw the little lines coming down for the Zeppelin where they'd sort of zipped down. I thought that was a nice detail. The scouts are after them, and one of them has an eagle demon scout. I wasn't sure if he was meant to have been, I don't know, severed or able to separate, or if he was just like, they were kind of at the edge of what you could do.
It's our kind of sort of conceit with the demons is that, you know, if you have a bird,
they can go a bit.
They should probably be able to fly. Otherwise, they're the worst demons ever. It's like, you know, because they're meant to signify that you're kind of, you know, a certain type of character, I think. And it's really strange because if your demon can't fly, it means that you're a completely different type. You're like the opposite character. It's like you have the potential, but you don't live up to it.
I was always wondering about this. Like, how do, you know, are there like Olympics in Lyra's world? Because like, what if you can run really fast, but your demon is, you know, like a short-legged dog or something? That's
brilliant.
It's genuine like, question.
I want to do the high jump, but I can't. Pole vault, but I can't do it because I've got like a very small insect.
My sloth won't
come with me. Well, I think the idea is that like, if you're the sort of person that's going to be an athlete, you've probably settled as something. Because you've got to remember that you're not born with that demon.
No, true.
It's not like, you know, so I think the idea is as you work out who you are, you know, like if I wanted to end up being like an athlete, I'd end up with a fast demon. So
that's what's kind of interesting about Lee Scoresby then, because he doesn't have a flying demon and he's an aeronaut. You know, he's got this very companionable sort of cute hair,
but he's not an aeronaut. He's an aeronaut after he's settled. He becomes an aeronaut later. So he becomes an aeronaut when he buys the balloon off someone or wins it in a card game or something. I can't remember which one it is. I assume it's a card
game. All right, Han Solo.
Exactly. Easy. It's not Hester's natural place to be anyway, and it's a learned skill rather than a given one, I guess.
Yeah, which in itself is telling. Mm. And let's let's talk about Hester and Lee in this, because I thought this was really, really heartbreaking stuff. I'll be honest. I mean, I said it last season. I didn't warm to Lin-Manuel Miranda and Lee Scoresby, and I was kind of a great. We weren't connecting personally, and I don't know why. Maybe it's just the picture of Lee in my head didn't quite meet.
He didn't look like Sam Elliott.
Yeah, perhaps. Perhaps. Let's face it. But I got to say, in this season, he really solidified himself in for me as that character. Mm. And I thought, particularly the prison scene and the time we spend with Lee and Joe Perry really, really works. And then to get to this point, even though you know as a book reader it's coming, it did sting. And I thought it was very beautifully executed. Those final moments, just this concept of, you know, being on your deathbed and this... the time he spends with the demon himself, and it's kind of self-reflective, and the sort of questioning guilt that she presents. You know, this is my fault, isn't it? It's quite touching.
Yeah, it's tricky stuff, isn't it? But I think there's something. Yeah, I think what you're saying is totally right. That's kind of, but it doesn't jump off the page maybe as much as when you start seeing it.
Yeah.
There's something about seeing like a person with a representation of themselves, and like when he says, "Don't you go before I do," and it's actually that it's not that he wants to die first; it's that he just doesn't want to see her go, you know.
Yeah.
Which I think is really, really beautiful, and I think and that relationship is really, really great. Mm-hmm. I love that, like, you know, like in that little run, we get Hester is like the wingman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he's like, shoot over there. And then we get like Hester is like the, like you say, the internal reflection on what they've done. And, you know, there's definitely a trend in there about how Lee doesn't like to kill.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And he's having a conversation with himself whilst killing, in which he's basically saying why it's okay that he has to do it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's such an interesting contrast to Mrs. Coulter as well, the closeness of Hester and Lee. Like, they've clearly come from similar abused childhoods, but Lee and Hester are so united in everything they do, really. They'll talk it out, but then they're so united, and then it's such a contrast, I feel like.
I think such a big part of that is spoken about actually in episode... I find the episodes really hard because we kept the episodes numbered as they were when we were going to have the fourth episode be the Asriel one, so I'm always one off. Basically, in the episode with the alethiometer heist, there is... you know, that episode, I think, does a really great job of digging into... Yeah, that episode is a woman's episode, right? It's about being a woman in these worlds, you know. And, you know, I think I love the stuff about, you know, how Mrs. Coulter could have been a scholar in one world and not in another. And I think the difference is, I really do think a big difference between how one person bounced back from something and the other person didn't is because of the kind of the opportunities afforded men in Lyra's world.
Right.
You know, like Mrs. Coulter is someone who had a lot and then lost it all and then had to claw her way back, whilst Azrael just kind of was fine, you know? So I think that's, you know, I really see that. And I also think that, you know, there's a different amount of damage when, you know, I think, you know, when you've had a kid and you've left a kid, whereas Lee hasn't had that experience, you know? So, but yeah, I think that sequence anyway with Lee and Hester is really, really lovely. Like it was quite, that's one of the scarier ones to do for us.
It's a big one in the book, yeah.
Yeah, and how do you just get a pair to emote in the way that you want? And again, most of it is again about doing less, not doing more. Because, you know, the audience can feel the emotion, and Lynn is doing such a great job that, you know, sometimes you just need to, like, not do stuff so the audience does it themselves, you know? And that's that thing that's the thing about animals, is that actually it's quite, you can lean on that. And sometimes if we had Hester, like, coughing and spluttering and, like, you know, like going that would be really rubbish. So restraint is again one of the biggest sort of assets I think you have to have when you do these shows. But yeah, I do like that sequence a lot. But it did scare me. My highlight of that experience was we were doing the temporary ADR recordings, or CDR for creature dialogue recordings, as we call them. We were doing them when we were all in lockdown,
right?
So I was in my flat in Wales doing all of these CDR sessions with all of these, like, great people, but, like, in my bedroom. So I was, like, doing, like, a session with David Suchet. And, like, amazing. It was honestly, the whole experience was beautiful, because you've got, like, David Suchet's at home. He's been sent a few little bits of kit, and he's trying to make his iPhone do the right thing. And he keeps being so, he's such a lovely guy, and he's being so sweet and going, oh, thank you so much for helping. And then there's, like, and actually he's being an absolute legend. And we did the same with all the demons, with Kit, with Pan, and with we did, you know, briefly with Phoebe Waller-Bridge for Joe Parry's demon. So, you know, but with Christella, when we did that, she basically has, like, she turned her, I guess, her cupboard or ward or, like, cloak room in her flat into a little recording studio. Right, so she had, like, drapes and stuff up.
Great.
And there was just something about it. They're like, she had we always have a reference camera, and that was kind of quite high, so we were slightly looking down on her, and she was doing all of these performances. And then when it got to Hester dying, she got really upset.
Oh.
Like she really, like, was so into it and tearful. And there was something about, I felt quite guilt. Like, I had this feeling of guilt. I was like, oh no, like, she's in New York in a flat in lockdown in a cupboard crying.
Oh no.
I feel terrible. And I'm watching. But yeah, she did. She was so amazing. Like, the way that all of them put their voices into the demons and really, really connect. And she connected so beautifully when she did that scene. Yeah. She basically did it, and we were like, think we're done then. You know, we won't do another take, because I think that was really good.
Yep. Slayed us all, so.
Exactly. So yeah, it was a nice experience.
That final, really.
I think it's sorry, Helen.
That final, we're helping Lyra is a bit of a heartbreaker, like, it really is.
Yeah.
There's a funny thing in that, which is that the original line we had was, we're helping Lyra, and then they adjusted it to be closer to the book, which is, we're a helping Lyra.
Oh.
And we were like, oh no, we've got to change the animation. We've got to add in that for the helping loan. But yeah, it's really, yeah, it's sweet. It's a sweet moment, and it's quite sad.
It's a testament to how good that scene is and how invested I was at that moment, that when Lee pulls up the cloud pine to ask for Serafina's help, I kind of forgot everything that I knew and was just like, yes, she's coming to save him. And I was just, I felt this moment of relief that, you know, was quickly crushed. So thanks, guys.
Aww. You're welcome.
This is like every single time I watch Romeo and Juliet, I'm like, this time she's going to wake up and this time it's going to happen.
It's like, with us though, we killed Roger, so you can be sure we're going to kill Lee.
Oh, you monster.
I'm really curious to see how the audience that haven't read the books react to it. Because that will be, I don't think anyone would expect that to be a character that carks it.
Yeah. It's true. Interesting as well, and I think I like this actually, about, it's a change to the book, because frankly it's more futile in the book. You know, here Lee holds them off long enough that we see a reunion between John and Will, which we don't get in the book. There's that just heartbreaking kind of missed connection moment in the book. And I, purists may disagree, but I am so glad they got their moment in this. I would have felt so cheated, I think, if they hadn't.
I think it's important. I think the thing, again, I imagine writing a book is a sort of a similar experience in that you go on a journey and things just feel right at the time.
Mm.
And it's just like when once you've started spending time with the characters, visually seeing them how they are, sort of like your needs change a little bit as a viewer, you know. And I think that's where when people get upset when we go off book, I totally understand it. But as I always say, like everything we do on the show is kind of done with love. Mm. Like we all love the material, we all love the books, and we're trying to do our best by them. But at the same time, we're trying to do the best by the characters that have been, you know, other people have now breathed life into them.
Mm-hmm.
And they've kind of become something of their own, and you have to go with what they should be now. Yeah, so like I always say, if people don't like the visual effects of the show, people ask me, they say, is there a lot of pressure in doing a show that's like a beloved, like, you know, like property? And I'm like, no, because I will really look forward to seeing them do it the way they like it later.
Yeah.
You know, if someone like thinks it's wrong, I'd love them to do it again, and I'd love to watch it, you know, because it's just, you know, it's people's take on it, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I think I'm with Helen. That scene felt better and more emotionally satisfying for me than kind of what we got in the book, but without betraying sort of the overall sense of kind of what happens and that sort of tragic end to it. But the and I think to you know, which kind of fits with your wider point, Russell, about the anytime you make changes, it is also to serve the characters. And I think the Emir Wilson really gets to shine in this scene in particular, with these conflicting emotions between Will and his father, and he's kind of instantly relieved and also curious, you know, you have a demon, but also then the anger and the accusations come, you know, when he learns about, you know, you chose those people over us. It's really heartbreaking stuff. And what's interesting is this Andrew Scott is playing Joe Parry as this somebody who is feeling, you know, similar, this like amazing moment where he sees his son, and this, you know, lifelong heartbreak feels like a little bit healed, but then he's kind of back on track. He's a bit of a zealot. He's got, you know, he's got his mission, you are the bearer, and then he starts telling, he's right into like, this is what you got to do, to the point where he completely forgets to even mention Lyra and his promise to yep. Lee, which is, that's how much of, and this show is filled with zealots, you know, he's quite a bit like Mrs. Coulter and them, but
and Asriel, he's a lot like Asriel.
And Asriel,
is that? But I think, you know, it's a lot of people with singular visions. And actually, funnily enough, a lot of the men have the more singular visions. You know, I think that's interesting. Like Mrs. Coulter has, you know, Mrs. Coulter is like a survivor.
Yeah,
you know, she's constantly surviving, and she has a growing mission inside of her to reconnect with her daughter and be a mother again. But yeah, there are a lot of people with singular visions. I think that's really, you know, I think Amir played that scene really, really well. And I'm glad that it's nice to hear that you guys didn't feel, because it's very different to the book, that whole section. You know, like we don't have Grooman being killed by a witch, and we don't have all that stuff. But it just didn't feel right at the time. You know, it didn't feel like the right things relative to where we're building to. So it's really nice that you guys feel sort of okay about that stuff. That's good.
Well, if you do the witch thing, you've got to start to establish the relationship, his relationship with that witch throughout, and it's kind of a whole other thing to do.
And you're basically doing that whole thing just so he can get killed by a witch. It doesn't really go anywhere. So it's sort of like it becomes a touch extraneous, where in a book it's great textual detail and it's great stuff to read, whereas in the precious minutes of television where you can't have moments be, you know, like I said last time we spoke, you know, 10 seconds is 10 seconds in TV. It's not 5 pages.
Yeah.
So I think it's really good. We had fun trying to work out how to kill the guy that shoots Joe Parry's demon with the two birds having a quick fight.
Yeah, I was trying to think, have we seen a demon kill a demon before?
No, we haven't. That was our first one.
Oh, yeah.
It's quite ruthless.
It was, yeah. Brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I was okay with it. Screw that guy, you know, whatever. Exactly. But I mean, it was still a bit like, woo.
Yeah, it's quite intense. And I quite like how protective it is.
Mm.
You know, it's very protective of both himself and of his son.
Yeah.
Which I like. It's very instinctual, you know.
Well, you get that moment. That's what you don't get in the books, that moment of self-sacrifice. Yeah. You know, he twists Will around to protect him. That's how, you know, it tells us again how focused he is on his mission. Yeah.
But also, I think it's a moment of love and a moment of fatherhood as well.
Yeah.
Not just mission.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. No, sorry, you're right. I forgot. Forgot there he is a father in there. But the bit that absolutely broke my heart in this scene was, again, kudos to Emir Wilson and this reluctant hero thing. And, you know, we've seen reluctant heroes, you know, throughout fiction, and it's a very common trope. But he's so reluctant to do any of this. He's in this episode, he wants to get away from the witches because he doesn't want them to get hurt. He doesn't really want any of this. And there are people dying around him. And now he's finally reunited with his father, and he's being told he's got to do more, and suddenly he's got to save worlds, and he's so important, and the poor guy doesn't want any of this. And then the line that crushed me was when Will says to him, and then we get to go home, you know, after all this. That's all he wants, and that he just wants to have his father back with his mother and have a simple life, and it absolutely ruined me.
Yeah, because you know, like when he's in his world, you know, his life is so complicated with his mother, and all he wants to do is be invisible.
Mm.
It's like, that's the whole thing about Will, is like, it's something that we don't play up that much as in the book, is that he's got this ability, like the witches, to kind of make themselves invisible, and it's not something that we delved into. But that idea, but we do with Will in terms of the fact that he likes to not be noticed and not be seen, and that's one of his skills. But, you know, I just sort of like, I do agree. I think like there's that thing that all he wants to do is go back to the world, have a mum and a dad, and be visible.
Yeah.
In a normal way, and just not have to be like a hidden part of society where he's trying to hide his mum's mental health issues to a bunch of bullying school kids. He just wants normal life back, you know? And you know, and the whole thing with this, the thing is, it's like, you know, like if you want to get out of the hole, you can't be invisible. You've got to stand up and do things, you know? And it's like his call to arms is, I think his reluctance is in being seen.
Yeah.
You know, to do these things, as much as it is the fear of doing them.
Mm. But also after what we saw last episode and him sort of swearing off violence, to have his long lost dad turn up and say, not just you're a warrior, but literally the fate of many worlds may rest on you. Like, it's like, oh, really? Are you kidding me? Seriously? I've just decided I'm not going to like hurt anybody. I'm not going to kill anybody. And I'm a warrior now. Oh.
Yeah. I think I'm going to do that with my kids' homework. When they won't do it, I'm going to be like, the fate of many worlds may rest on the result of this work. And see what that does to their mental health.
Yeah. How many times do you think you can get away with that?
just the one, I reckon. And then I'm going to have to lean into the results of that for the rest of my life. It'll be like on the news, there'll be like a crash, and a plane crash. I'll be like, that's because of the homework.
Wow.
That's your C+ there.
Exactly. That's it. It's the result. I'm so sorry. Yeah.
Well, let's finish off where we are with Will then. So the last moment we see Will in the final montage is him literally adopting his father's mantle, which I liked. This the hood. He's become the shaman, the sexy shaman.
Yeah.
And that, by the way, the costume design. I mean, we've kind of talked about it already, but I really liked Joe Parisse. Like that's a cosplay waiting to happen.
It's quite out of left field. His character, like, I remember seeing him for the first time, and I was like, I was not expecting that, but I quite like it.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, I like the vibe of him.
Yeah.
You know, I like that we didn't end up with some frazzled old guy with like lots of like scraggly beard and bits of sort of old soup in it. You know, I like that I really liked the way he's very contemporary, which I liked. Mm. That was a really good take.
And he's very lived in. And I also like the jumper he's got on, right? So he's got, you know, he's got the cool otherworldly hood that's got this kind of, but he's got like this jumper that just looks like it's from our world. So it is this kind of mismatched, looks like he picked it up at a charity shop.
Yeah.
So it's like this lovely sort of reminder of he's a patchwork person in himself, and he's coming from different places, and but also hand tattoos.
Hand tattoos, big takeaway there. I also like the fact that he's another predominant character who has stumbled into where he is. You know, like the idea is that, you know, in his backstory is he goes to the north on an expedition and stumbles his way into another world, can't get back, and he ends up here.
Yeah.
He ends up like realizing that, you know, like he wants to leave a great world for his kids and that there's all this stuff wrong with it, and he wants to, you know, leave them with freedom, you know?
Because if he can't get home, at least he can do that.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and that's the thing is I think it's a really good point is that he hasn't, it's not that he chose not to go back. It's that he chose to do something faced with the fact that he can't go back.
Right.
Still for his family, which is lovely. It's lovely.
Yeah. We should probably just have a quick talk about Will and Lyra before we go on to that final montage, which was very big for all the characters. But, you know, we have had that scene of Pan bonding with Will earlier in the episode, which was really kind of lovely, like Pan sort of saying what Lyra maybe can't or hesitates to or doesn't want to say out loud. There's a sense that
it's my second favourite scene. It is, genuinely.
It's really lovely because it feels like Lyra's hesitant to call Will her best friend because of what happened to the last one, but he is, and she knows that, and Pan admits it even if she can't.
I also I don't know if you picked up on it. I mean, it's to me, it's really clear because we did the work, but you might not have picked up, and that's fine if you didn't. But there's also like a slight sharpness in Pan. Mm. There's a very slight bitterness in him when he's like, "You're her best friend too," and then he like sort of walks away and he's like, "Get some more sleep. Hopefully you feel better." And he kind of like he says it over his shoulder, like we tried to make his body language just a little bit like, you know, I feel like I'm being replaced. It's not all about me anymore. So we tried to have a little hint of that in there. Whether or not it comes through or not, I don't know. But I think there's something really sweet about that scene, and I think, you know, everything from like just the staging of it, the lighting of it all just worked really, really nicely. And and I do like the kind of the I feel like there's a like Pan is having a bit of a maturing journey as well, which I really like. We were talking the other day because we picked the red panda for him as a demon because, well, mostly because I was working out what demons to do for them for season two, and I went to the zoo and I saw a red panda and I was watching it, and not only are they like really adorable,
I mean, super
which
adorable.
Is cool, but there was something I really loved about them because they were quite they're kind of exotic, right, which is Lyra in a new world, but they're kind of a bit clumsy, which is like teenage girl with a new boy, right?
yeah
and I liked that. I liked that there's like this combination of like beauty and clumsiness in the way they move and the way they look. So I remember I came back and I pitched that as a new demon to Jane and Joel Collins and the rest of the team, and they were all like, yeah, let's do it. And then Joel built it into like the Chittagatsi set design.
Oh, wow.
Like the there's like posters on the wall for a cola that the logo is a panda that eats the berries that are in the town, and those berries
are
on the tree outside the front of the cafe. You know, there's like all of these like little references that they put in, and we kind of really lent into it because we also, even if you, it's that whole idea of like seasoning the show with like secret ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's this thing in the book that basically says that the reason why Lyra changes into more demons is because she is more imaginative, and part of that is because she's been exposed to more things through her studies and her education, where most children wouldn't get that.
Mm-hmm.
So we really like the idea that she turns up in this new world, sees a drink that's got a red panda on it, wants to slightly impress the boy, turns into a panda that's a bit thingy, but that panda is a little bit clumsy. You know, I mean, it's all these little thoughts that we have that kind of make the decisions.
That's awesome.
But then at the same time, being able to return to classic Pan Ermin for that chat with Will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why we chose that, because it's her at her most sort of exposed, I think, because it's the most vulnerable demon that she has, really, apart from the moth. But hey. But you know, like it looks sweet and innocent. It's sort of harks back to the youth of her in season one. Mm. It's what she is when she sleeps. So I think it's really nice that that's the duo is her is Pan as an Ermin and Will. I like it a lot.
That's really nice. By the way, was Pan a Wolverine during that fight with Mrs. Coulter?
Yes. That is not that is comically a reference to the X-Men Logan. Franchise, but it's not. Yeah. It's not why it's we not. Picked it. It's A in the books. Mm. I think not
yeah,
in
think
that
it is.
Scene.
Yeah.
It's not in that scene, but at
it
some
has,
point,
yeah, it was somewhere else. Yeah.
But also, one of the things with doing the demons is trying to maintain a thread of character. And when you look at what we we've chosen, like a panda is kind of like a red panda has like bear-like movements in the way that their feet move. Pan is also a mustelid, which is like a pine marten a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And then a wolverine is a very strange mix between a bear and a mustelid.
Yeah.
So what she becomes is she becomes two of the things that she's kind of feeling at that moment, and she becomes the aggressive form of that. But it's still familiar to you as a viewer. It doesn't feel weird.
Mm.
You're like, whoa, she's turned into like this thing that's totally outrageous. You feel like it feels natural and it feels kind of comfortable, I think. Mm. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So the we do get that lovely bonding scene, and we get quite a few sort of nice Will and Lyra character moments in this episode. It is very, you know, for a season finale, there is a lot of action here, but for our central characters, I like that it was a bit more sort of introverted, and it feels like a sort of cementing of their relationship. And we get this sort of, you know, following Pan and Will's chat, Lyra is a bit conflicted, isn't she? She's a kind of afraid of losing another best friend. And Pat, and sort of they're trying to decide what to do. And she has that conversation with Pan where, you know, he doesn't think they should leave the witches. And I like that he acknowledges, you know, verbally that, or she says, I'm changing. And Pan says, is it Will who's changing you?
I love that scene.
It's really nice that they're having this dialogue about what kind of what's happening to them, and the going through. It's almost like the birds and the bees chat, but without a parent. Or without any answers.
And for us, the really interesting stuff with that is in like the energy of Pan when he's delivering those lines.
Mm.
So like when he says, "Is it Will that's changing you?" Like we build a little hang and a little pause in there, because if you're asking yourself that question internally, it's a slightly uncomfortable question.
Yep. There's a half an accusation in there, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly. So when Pan says that, he's walking, and as he says it, his head dips a little bit, his feet slow, and then he picks it up. Like it's like he just has to slightly get that question out.
And that's all that.
Like I said, it's that idea of like flavoring performance with movement, because you haven't got, you know, you've got to reference body language as well. So. I really love that. And it's like, I don't think, she says, I don't think I'm ready to change. And then someone says, I don't think anybody is, or the other way around, actually, with their lines. It's a great little scene, that. I love it.
There is one tiny incidental moment I noticed in that scene, which probably doesn't necessarily build on character, but I just liked was Pan as the ermine is like on one rock. He's on a rock, and then he moves to another rock, but flips to a bird in between, and then back to the ermine. And I just like, it's just a reminder that the demons can do this and how agile they are, and I really enjoyed that.
That's something we did a little bit more actually we did it again in like the second episode when Boreal steals the alethiometer.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like there's something about that kind of energy that we realized that we slightly hadn't quite hit in the first season that we liked, that idea that like just instinct. It's like, this is happening, I'll become this and do this. Like, I think there's something really nice about that, and it helps with the energy. So that's something we, you know, like you do anything, you watch what you did the first time, you go, what can we do to tweak and improve, and what did we not quite get? And that's something that I felt that we needed more of.
Yeah.
Those little incidental bits.
Absolutely. And then the sort of, it's almost the breaking of the fellowship, isn't it? So you've got Will and Lyra and this witch, after Serafina goes off to try and help Lee. But they all fall asleep, and which seems like a bad idea,
Terrible idea.
Yeah. Who's this? The witch, of all people, should have been awake at the very least.
Well, she's maybe still recovering from the demon attack, or from the spectre attack before.
I'd like to think so.
Still, somebody should have stayed awake.
Somebody should have stayed awake, because Will is sort of drawn off by shaman powers, I guess. Lyra is taken away and put in a box. And one of Mrs. Coulter's pet specters, well, sees to the witch.
Yes, it's quite a strange scene. That you're right. I mean, it is you know, it is a bit convenient that she falls asleep, but it is, yeah, it does make sense that she's exhausted.
Yeah.
And I like,
we'll give you that.
Yeah,
you get a pass.
Exactly. But I think there is something that there's something I really like about the fact that, you know, Mrs. Coulter sort of like quietly and silently still spectres the witch in her sleep. It's quite horrible.
Yeah.
I mean, Miss Scott does a lot of horrible stuff in this season.
Yeah, really, you know? Really horrible.
Yeah.
I think you have to have that, because like I remember that scene in the book where she suddenly tells the spectres they can fly. So you don't have that here. The spectres can pretty much fly from the beginning. But that scene in the book where she goes, oh, you're not actually tied to the ground, and then they just float up and attack the witches and attack the zeppelins. That's terrifying, and I love that you got the sense of that across without actually having the same scene.
Yeah, it's basically like having the sense that we always took it that really it's that the spectres learn that they are, that, you know, that they can be controlled is more interesting, I think, for us, because learning they can fly is cool, but, you know, taking away their ability to fly so they can only crawl around on the floor kind of takes away something from the rest of the show. It's kind of quite a big concession to make. But then at the same time, I think, you know, the story from our side with the show, it seems anyway, is it's about Mrs. Coulter's abilities to do what she can do, because we have to build to what she manages to do in book three. And it's, you know, and we're building on this idea that she is this incredibly magnetic, controlling person, you know, like, so, you know, like she can be the person that, like, all men want to, you know, like, listen to and, you know, basically be with. But she can also, you know, separate herself emotionally so much that, like, you know, this kind of horrific creature will do her bidding. Mm. You know, you know, like, she has such like psychological power, and I think that's for us the story. So just using that is more interesting.
Yeah.
You know. But yeah, it's a pretty dark scene anyway when she spectres that witch on her own. It's quite funny.
Well, will we take this thing home then? Will we talk about we get this final montage with a sort of call to arms voiceover from James McAvoy and Lord Asriel back in action.
Yes.
And we don't know who he's addressing. Until he starts calling them out quite aggressively. I like how he's like, you know, it's classic Asriel. He's like, even in a moment where he's like confronting angels, and he's very much feels like he's in charge and he's in command, and he's telling them, this is what we've got to do, come out now, where the fuck are you, come on.
Yeah.
And then they sort of appear and say, we stand with you. So big moment, welcome back Lord Asriel.
Indeed.
You're for me or against me. There is no neutral ground. It's like, okay, all right.
Yeah.
You and whose army, mate? But okay.
Exactly. So yeah, that was something that we always knew that we needed to end, especially when we lost having the episode with James. We always knew that we needed to end with James.
Right.
And where we brought the angels in was interesting. The angels are, again, tricky. And they really do deserve like an entire season's worth of development to work out. So we also knew that we didn't want to suddenly turn everything into an angel fest. So we didn't have the scene, for example, where Will talks with the angels. It didn't feel right. It didn't feel like it built to the right point and didn't leave. You know, like, you want that to be the carrot for next season to a degree, like this whole kind of promise of the angels. So, but I mean, what I do really like about that is I really like the fact that, yeah, Asriel looks battered. So there's a story there. Mm-hmm. Like, where's he been? What's he been doing? And you sort of feel that he's been on a journey himself. And I love that he does this call to arms. And then I love that there's something, and it's something that we talked about when we were shooting it. I loved that James has like a tiny moment of vulnerability when he sort of thinks that it's not going to happen. And we built that. We sort of built that in there. And actually, I mean, that scene was, for me personally, quite good fun, because that was, we'd done all of that, and then that came in around quite late, and I actually shot that scene. That was my, they kind of left that one up to me, and it's quite a privilege actually. But James, I thought his take on it was really, really good and really interesting.
Yeah.
And that little bit of doubt, I just love the fact that it is plausible that it's there,
mm-hmm.
but it also feels like exhausted doubt. You know, it's kind of like, it's kind of weariness rather than like, I'm really doubting myself. It's just like, oh God, come on.
Yeah, because he doesn't want it all to be for nothing, right? Everything that he's gone
I've
through.
I've struggled through
all,
many
all there
worlds.
In his face.
Yeah,
and it feels like he's, exactly. It feels like he's sort of psychologically kind of like, this is the last one almost, you know, even though it probably wouldn't be knowing Asriel's character. It feels like in that moment, he's like last ditch attempting it. I really like that. And I kind of really like the landscape in that scene as well. Like, I thought the team did a really good job of making some kind of weird basalt sort of sort of otherworldly landscape without it seeming too, again, with us, it's like we're trying to ease into that fantasy without suddenly going like Sledgehammer of Fantasy, which is actually my new nickname. Now I thought
also be a good metal band name.
The Sledgehammer of Fantasy. But yeah, anyway, I think I really like the scene. I think it's a nice way to end as well, and I think it's also good that you know, like, there's that nice thing about introducing like a well-known character's voice that you haven't heard in a long time whilst you're seeing all of this kind of rousing imagery. You've got, you know, like, I love the Yorick staring out at the collapsing iceberg. I love all of that. I think all of that stuff's really, 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 really cool. So you get this kind of voice, and you're like, and it's that idea of like holding on to it. So you wait and wait and wait. You see all this imagery, and you want to see McAvoy, and then you just get him right at the end. I think it's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, and also if you have a voice to narrate things and it can be James McAvoy's, then bonus.
I mean,
you
know, always go for it.
Then it should be.
Always go for it, yeah.
If people out there haven't listened to the Sandman audiobook on Audible, I highly, highly recommend it.
Oh, does he do that?
He does, yeah. He's the Sandman.
I've got the whole anthology of Sandman over there that I keep needing to read.
I've got the big leather-bound version.
That's what I've got over there, yeah.
They're so good.
All right, guys, showing off your backgrounds. I don't have any books back here.
I'm so sorry.
It's good podcast chat. Okay, well, speaking of big season 3 build-ups and call to arms and battles, Russell, how much can you tell us about where you are with season 3? When our audience and your audience can expect to see it?
I can tell you very little.
Hope it's sooner rather than later.
I can tell you very little. I can tell you that, I mean, it's not officially a greenlit season. To me, it's greenlit when it's in the press.
Right.
You know what I mean? Okay. When it's in the press, it's greenlit. But we are obviously in early prep for it. We're, you know, taking what is a very complex book, breaking it down. You know, we've got to deal with, you know, Malefa. Mm-hmm. Which is oddly not the scariest part of it, you know, because what we know is we've done Yorick. We know that we can do really, really emotional creatures acting with people. Like, we're not, that doesn't worry me. I've got an amazing animation team, an amazing creature team. It's up, you know, we've got to decide where on the scale of how much we go completely with the book or not. You know, that's a whole conversation. But you know, the Malefa is not the scary bit. The scary bit is first of all making it work well on TV.
Yeah,
because it works really well as a book, but it uses a lot of the concessions that you can get with a book to kind of, you know, where you find out information is probably fine in a book, but you need to find it out like much earlier in a season, probably for television. So it's like trying to work all of that stuff out is really, really, really complicated. And, you know, I know the guys are going through that, and we're having kind of early chats, and we're sort of starting with our early design processes and all those things, but that's all I'm going to tell you.
Fair enough.
Because that's all I know.
Yeah. Without any spoilers, it's fair to say this is going to get cosmic in season 3.
Exactly. So it is definitely a leap into a new place, which is cool.
Yeah,
so it's gonna be fun.
Cannot wait.
Let's hope it happens.
Amen. Absolutely. Fingers crossed. And we should just quickly mention the post-credit sting here. Poor little Roger, adorable Roger.
Yeah.
Yes.
Calling for help.
Where could he possibly be? He's in another box next to next to Lyra.
this is a setting a bad example for boxes all over the world.
I think it might be. Yeah, but no, I like that. I thought it was a nice little addition. It's very much, you know, and one of the exciting bits about next season. So it's cool.
Good teaser. And I think for people who haven't read the book, a real like curveball.
Did you notice there's a little shadow in their background behind him?
I couldn't tell what it was.
Yeah, if you've read the books, then you'll think about where he is and what that might be. It's cool. Anyway.
I'm gonna go back to that. Well, that's it, Helen. We did it. We got to the end.
Well done.
We did nothing. We just talked about
it was exhausting.
TV show
talking,
you made.
His Darker Materials is a Stripped Media production. Our executive producers are Kobe Omanaka and Tom Wally. The episode was edited, mixed, and sound designed by Tom Wally. This episode was produced by Helen O'Hara and Dave Corkery. All our music was composed by John Dix. Our artwork was created by Sam Gilby. And the excerpt read at the top of the show was taken from the book The Subtle Knife by Philip Pullman and published by Scholastic. This episode was recorded remotely in parallel worlds. Finally, big thank you to James Carroll and the team at Northbank Talent Management.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.
If you're listening to this podcast, you must recognize the value of asking questions. At Aramco, our questions help us engineer a better future. How can today's resources fuel our shared tomorrow? How can we deliver energy to a world that can't stop? How can we deliver one of the fuels of the future? How can we sow curiosity to harvest ingenuity? To learn more about how innovation drives us forward, visit aramco.com/poweredbyhow.